TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Bringing Down Civilization. A Talk by Derek Jensen. A Talk by Derek Jensen is an improvisational, non-linear event attended by personal friends, loyal fans, and loyal critics. The setting is non-hierarchical, with a lot of give and take. This young writer, with almost 10 books to his credit, earned such attention for his intellectual courage, his very memorable jokes, and his unflinching support of the living earth, of salmon, forests, and rivers. Derek Jensen wrote in his early book, Listening to the Land, "We are members of the most destructive culture ever to exist. Our assault on the natural world, on indigenous and other cultures, on women, on children, on all of us, through the possibility of nuclear suicide, all these are unprecedented in their magnitude and ferocity." And he follows that with a question. Why do we act as we do? What are sane and effective responses to outrageously destructive behavior? What will it take for us to stop the horrors that characterize our way of being? My work and life revolve around these questions. When I recorded Derek Jensen in the Oakland, California warehouse of AK Press, he asked that question in a much more pointed way. If civilization is destroying us and the earth, do we need to bring down civilization? Here is Derek Jensen.
I was down in Asheville, North Carolina, and doing Q&A, and this guy asked, how many environmentalists does it take to change a light bulb? And I said, I'll bite. How many? And he said, well, actually, that was an honest question. I don't know. It's like, that's not how the joke's supposed to work. And that's one of the neat things about being a writer is, you know, people will ask me all sorts of questions, and a lot of times they think I'm, like, really smart because they ask a question, then I answer. But the thing is, that's because, you know, somebody asked me that question 3 months ago, and I said, I don't know what the hell you're talking about. And then, you know, 4 weeks later, I come up with an answer, and then next time it's like, oh, yeah, I'm so bright. And so anyway, that night, and this probably says more about my social life than I wanted to, late that night I was sort of ruminating on how many environmentalists does it take to change a light bulb when I got the answer, which is 10. One to write the light bulb or letter requesting a change, 4 to circulate online petitions, 1 to file a lawsuit, 1 to send the light bulb loving kindness, knowing that this is the only way a real change occurs, 1 to accept the light bulb precisely the way it is, clear in the knowledge that to not accept another is to do great harm to oneself, 1 to write a book about how and why the light bulb must change, and finally, 1 to smash the light bulb because we all know it's never going to change. So as a longtime grassroots environmental activist, and as a creature living in the thrashing endgame of civilization, I am intimately acquainted with the landscape of loss and have grown accustomed to carrying the daily weight of despair. I've walked clear cuts that wrap around mountains and drop into valleys and climb ridges to fragment watershed after watershed, and I've sat silent near empty streams that 2 generations ago were lashed into whiteness by uncountable salmon coming home to spawn and die. A few years ago, I began to feel pretty apocalyptic, but I hesitated to use that word, in part because of those cartoons I've seen of crazy penitents carrying the end is near signs, and in part because of the power of the word itself, apocalypse. I didn't want to use it lightly. And then a friend and fellow activist said to me, "So Derek, what will it take for you to finally use that word? Will it take the death of salmon? Death of runs of salmon so thick that people were afraid to put their boats in water for fear they'd capsize, so thick that they would keep people awake at night with the slapping of their tails against the water, so thick that horses were afraid to get in the water." I was up on Mill Creek near where I live up in by Crescent City yesterday. Isn't it amazing how many creeks are called Mill Creek? That's pretty awful. Anyway, I was up on Mill Creek. I saw 2 salmon swim by, 2 beautiful, wonderful salmon. And it made me cry, in part because they were so beautiful, and in part because it was two salmon. And anyway, this person gave me a picture of this river in southern Alaska. And if you look at it at first, it looks like there's just a dark bottom on the river. You know, the edge of the river is sort of yellow, sandy, and then it gets dark in the middle. But then if you look more closely, you see that the reason that it's dark is because it's filled with fish. It is literally filled with fish. I mean, you couldn't step into the river without stepping on fish. And I showed the picture to my mom, and she said, yeah, that'll last about another 10 or 15 years. Civilization needs to come down now. Like, groovy, Mom. Anyway, so this friend was saying, so will it take the death of the runs of salmon? Maybe it'll take the death of flocks of passenger pigeons so large they darken the sky for days at a time. The death of flocks of Eskimo curlews just as large. Maybe it'll take the turning of the sea off San Diego into a dead zone. Maybe it'll take global warming. I'm sure you've know that this just out, krill populations have collapsed by 70% in the last 20 years in Antarctica. And when you mess with the krill, it's all over. I mean, it is over. 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. 90%. The response by the head of the National Marine Fisheries Services to that was, and this is a direct quote, we have to ask ourselves what level of decline is reasonable or sustainable. So, you know, my friend kept asking, you know, what will it finally take for you to finally use that word, Derek? Give me a specific threshold at which you'll finally use the word apocalypse. Thanks, George. Just yesterday, I was talking to somebody about the krill, and we got into an argument, actually, because I said, you know, this culture is killing the planet. And he said, I think kill is kind of a strong word. I said, what do you call, 90% of the large fish being gone? And he said, I think it's changing. It's changing the planet. And I said, 90%. He said, okay, changing a lot. And I said, okay, what would you say if somebody cut off your arm? And then they cut off your other arm. And they cut off your leg. I mean, are you being killed or are you just being changed? And the conversation sort of went downhill from there. I've heard it said that one of the first rules of propaganda is that if you can slide your premises by people, you've got them. And so, for example, you hear a talking head on television say, how can we make the U.S. economy grow? It's like, oh, God, I don't know. Let's think about that. But there's some premises there. First off, we want the U.S. economy to grow. Second, we want the U.S. economy to exist. Third, who the hell's we? And it's kind of like with, it was said of Hitler, from insane premise to monstrous conclusion, Hitler was coldly, icily logical. If he could get you to buy into the premise that there is a Jewish problem, then it's like, okay, how are we going to solve it? And then he can move from there. And it's best if he doesn't even say it, but if he just slides it by you and you move from there. And this is inherent everywhere. I mean, it's inherent, very, very deeply inherent in our language. I'll give two examples of that really quickly. One of them is that the other day a friend was talking to me and said, so how much longer do you think we're going to be in Iraq? And I said, we're in Iraq? I thought we were in Northern California. And this friend knows me, so she just shook her head, and then she said, no, how much longer do you think our troops are going to be in Iraq? I said, I got troops? Is it okay? Can I, like, send them up to the Columbia and have them take out the Grand Coulee? I mean, what? Will they listen to me? And she said, okay, I'll tell you what. I'm going to call you tomorrow, okay? And the point is that if they can get us to say we, then we're fighting ourselves as well as them. And we'll get there in a minute, but if I could get one thing across in my work, it would be that the government is a government of occupation and the culture is a culture of occupation. And, of course, all of my American Indian friends will say, what took you so long to figure that one out? And, I mean, what does a government of occupation do? It moves in, it extracts resources, and doesn't care about communities. That's the definition. If Nazis or other fascists took over North America, what would we all do? Well, yeah, we'd vote. What would we all do if they implemented Mussolini's definition of fascism? Fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism because it's a merger of state and corporate power. And what would we then do if they instituted laws allowing them to put a significant portion, say one-third, of all Jewish males between the ages of 18 and 35 into concentration camps? What if this occupied country called itself a democracy, but most everyone understood elections to be shams, with citizens allowed to choose between different wings of the same fascist, or following Mussolini, corporate, party? What if anti-government activity was opposed by stormtroopers and secret police? Oh, I'm going to tell you my secret fantasy, which won't be secret after this, which is that the next time they have one of those FTAA meetings or WTO or whatever, that all the cops will suddenly turn around and they'll start shooting at the WTO representatives. Some people fantasize about Nicole Kidman. I fantasize about shooting it. Anyway, it's not going to happen. It has happened. It did happen. It happened in the French Revolution. It happened in 1873 or 1877 or something like that when some militia members in Pennsylvania turned their guns over to the strikers.
Venezuela.
Yeah, oh, that's true. It's too bad we have to go so far back in the U.S. Anyway, would you fight back? If there already existed a resistance movement, would you join it? Substitute the word African-American for Jewish and ask yourself the same questions. Now, would you resist if the fascists irradiated the countryside, poisoned food supplies, made rivers unfit for swimming, and so filthy you wouldn't even dream of drinking from them anymore? By the way, I can tell you exactly why. I don't see any here, but if I had a thing of bottled water, I would hold it up and I would say, this is why we're not going to have a revolution, because if people will pay for water bottled in plastic, they will suffer any indignity. What if they did this because, hell, I can't finish that sentence because no matter how I try, I can't come up with a motivation good enough even for fascists to irradiate and toxify the landscape and water supplies. If fascists systematically deforested the planet, would you join an underground army of resistance, head to the force, and from there to the boardrooms and to the halls of the Reichstag to pick off the occupying deforesters, and most especially those who give them their marching orders? I mean, what would we do if a bunch of aliens came down from outer space and they started to systematically vacuum the oceans and they dammed every river? There are, in the United States, there are 70,000 dams larger than 6 feet tall and 2 million dams total. Which means if we only took out one dam, one large dam every day, it would only take us 200 years to take them all out. Anyway, what would we do if aliens came down from outer space and they started to put dioxin in every mother's breast milk, flame retardant in every mother's breast milk? If they started to melt the ice cap, and I don't know if you saw this article in the New York Times the other day talking about the benefits of melting the polar ice cap. Okay, so what would we all do if they did this? I think we would all put on our camel outfits, grab our AK-47s, head off to the wrong audience. Am I the only person here with an AK-47? How many people in this room have had someone? How many of you have had someone that you love die of cancer? That's what, 60, 70%, 80% maybe? Yeah.
How about more than one?
We're still about half. Cancer is, of course, caused by the toxification of the entire environment in great measure. Okay. So maybe your sense of kin and your sense of skin doesn't extend to the natural world. Maybe you don't yet love the land where you live enough that you'll fight for it. But what if the fascists toxify not only the landscape, but the bodies of those you love? What if their actions put dioxin, dozens of other carcinogens, in the flesh of your lover, children, mother, brother, sister, father? Would you fight back? What if the fascists toxify your own body? Would you still cling to the illusion that their edicts carry more weight than that brought to bear by their secret and not-so-secret police? Would you work for this regime? Would you teach others its virtues? Or would you fight back? If you won't fight back when they toxify your own body, when will you fight back? Give me, and more importantly yourself, a specific threshold at which you finally take a stand. If you can't or won't give that threshold, why not? None of these questions are rhetorical. The questions are real. They are, at this point, some of the most important questions there are. I'm talking to human beings who are on a planet that's being changed dramatically. So, if you can slide your premises by people, you've got them. So, in the new book, I didn't want to do that. I wanted to lay out my premises in boldface so that if people don't like the premises, they won't get suckered in. And the first premise of the book is that industrial civilization is not and can never be sustainable. And a few years ago, and that should be pretty obvious, I'm embarrassed even to have to say it. A few years ago, I was riding a car with a friend of mine, and we got George Drafin, with whom I've written a few books, and we got stuck in traffic, and I'm just making conversation. I say, so George, if you could live at any level of technology that you wanted, what would it be? And George can be kind of a curmudgeon, and that day he was in a very curmudgeonly mood and said, Derek, that's a really stupid question. We can fantasize whatever we want, but the truth is there's only one level of technology that's sustainable, and that's the Stone Age. And we will be there again someday, and the only question will be what's left of the world when we get there. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of living based on the use of non-renewable resources isn't sustainable. When you run out, they're gone. Or any way of living based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources. If there are fewer salmon return every year, eventually you run out. And it doesn't take, it takes anybody but a rocket scientist, like I said, to figure out any of this stuff. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that you can't survive using more energy than comes in from the sun every year. And so I ask people all over the country, do you believe that the dominant culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? Nobody ever says yes. A lot of people laugh. And one guy, one of my talks, raised his hand. Everybody looked at him. He said, oh, voluntary. No, of course not. And the next question is, if you don't believe that the dominant culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, and if you care about your land base, what does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics? And the answer is that we don't know. And the reason we don't know is because we spend so much time hoping that there will be a miracle that we don't actually talk about what's directly in our face. Okay. Industrial civilization is not and can never be sustainable. Okay, it's really great, Derek, that you love to bash civilization, but can you define it, please? And I figure when I did this book, I've been bashing civilization for about 10 years, so I probably better finally go ahead and do that. And I've defined civilization as a way of life characterized by the growth of cities. And that's defensible both linguistically. Civilization comes from the root civitatis, which means city. And that's true. That's defensible historically, too. That's nice, Derek, but what's a city? Okay, so I've defined a city as a collection of people, not a community, a collection of people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. That means that the Talua, on whose land I now live, were not civilized because they didn't require the importation of resources. They lived in villages, camps. I mean, they ate salmon, huckleberry, clams, salmon, elk, salmon. And I was up in Spokane, Washington a few years ago doing a radio interview, and the radio interviewer asked me, or he said, you know, Indians exploited salmon too. And I said, no, they didn't. They ate them. And he said, well, what's the difference? And I said, well, they gave him respect for the spirit in exchange for the flesh. I knew that was kind of bullshit, but I'm a male, so I had to give an answer. And that afternoon, I went out and I sat next to this tree And that answer is true so far as it goes, but there's more to it. I knew that. And so I asked the tree, what is the fundamental predator-prey relationship? And the tree gave me the answer immediately, which is, if you consume the flesh of another, you take responsibility for the continuation of the other's community. And this is true on a moral level, it's true on a spiritual level, it's true on a physical level. So if I consume salmon from Mill Creek, I am now responsible for the continuation of that community. And when someone eats me, they will now be responsible for the continuation of my community. And everybody knows this. I mean, wood ducks know it. Tadpoles know it. Backstriders know it. If the backstriders eat all the tadpoles, guess what? Ain't going to be any more tadpoles to eat. So resources don't exist. Okay, having said that, we're going to use that word a lot still. Okay, so any way of living characterized by the growth of cities can never be sustainable. Because if you require the importation of resources, it means that you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource, and as your city grows, you will denude the landscape in an ever larger area. The second thing it means is that if you require the importation of resources, your way of living must be based on violence. And the reason that this is true is because trade will never be sufficiently reliable. If the people in the next watershed over have some resource that you need and they're not willing to share it with you, if you need it, you're going to take it. And this is different than the sort of free trade that a lot of Indians would have, where they would trade for non-essentials. This is totally different. That's actual honest-to-goodness free trade. What this means is that we could all become junior bodhisattvas, and it wouldn't matter. The U.S. military would still have to be huge and still have to invade all those other countries so we can get our oil. So the implications of that are really striking. Okay, second premise of the book is that traditional communities do not often voluntarily give up or sell the resources on which their communities are based until their communities have been destroyed. It follows that those who want the resources will do what they can to destroy traditional communities. Third premise. Industrial civilization is based on, requires, and would collapse very quickly without persistent and widespread violence. Fourth premise. This is my favorite one, I think. Civilization is based on a clearly defined and widely accepted, yet often unarticulated hierarchy. Violence done by those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is nearly always invisible, that is, unnoticed. When it's noticed, it's fully rationalized. Violence done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher is unthinkable, and when it does occur, is regarded with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims. Now, I'm sure that you know, for example, that between 4 and 6 Americans die every day because they encounter police. But every time a cop dies, there's this big state funeral, and, I mean, do you know what the most dangerous civil service profession is? Garbage collection. When was the last time you saw a state funeral for a garbage collector? When was the last time you saw a Tom Cruise movie where he's this intrepid garbage man cleaning up the mean streets of L.A.? And so, also, obviously, that's how it goes with violence, that, you know, if a cop kills a non-resisting person or a resisting person, well, let's think actually about protests, where what would happen if we all showed up at protests wearing body armor and carrying guns? Okay, so a cop beats people with essentially a baseball bat and nothing happens. But if you don't believe that this hierarchy exists, then try taking a baseball bat to a cop. And, you know, I'll talk to you in about 50 years. It's true within families. My father's extremely violent. And, the one time my brother fought back, he got beaten far worse than any other time because he had committed blasphemy. Fifth premise of the book. The property of those higher on the hierarchy is more valuable than the lives of those below. It is acceptable for those above to increase the amount of property they control, in everyday language to make money, by destroying or taking the lives of those below. This is called production. If those below damage the property of those above may kill or otherwise destroy the lives of those below. This is called justice. Sixth premise. Civilization isn't redeemable. This culture will not undergo any sort of voluntary transformation to a sane, sustainable way of living. If we don't put a halt to it, civilization will continue to immiserate the vast majority of humans and to degrade the planet until it, civilization, and probably the planet collapses. The effects of this degradation will continue to harm humans and non-humans for a very long time. Seventh premise. The longer we wait for civilization to crash, or the longer we wait before we ourselves bring it down, the messier will be the crash, and the worse things will be for those humans and non-humans who live during it and for those who come after. If somebody would have brought down civilization, whatever that means, 150 years ago, people on the eastern seaboard would still have passenger pigeons to eat. I mean, this is even ignoring passenger pigeons' existence, independent of calories. And I can guarantee that 50 years from now, there will be people sitting along the banks of the Columbia River. Well, they'll be glowing, for one thing. And they will be saying, I am starving to death because you didn't take out the dams that were killing the salmon. And the dams that were killing the salmon were there to provide electricity so that people could smelt aluminum, so that corporations could smelt aluminum for cheap beer cans. It's like, God damn you. Eighth premise of the book. The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of the economic system. I'll say it again. It's pretty obvious. The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of the economic system. Another way to put the eighth premise is, any economic or social system that doesn't benefit the natural communities on which it is based is unsustainable, immoral, and really stupid. Sustainability, morality, and intelligence, as well as justice, requires the dismantling of any such economic or social system, or at the very least disallowing it from damaging your land base. I gave a couple talks up in Eugene a couple years ago, and there was two of them the same day, and there was a woman who hated my talk so much and hates my work so much that she came to both talks so she could attack me. And I admired her persistence. And what she did is she at both talks, she accused me of being a combination of Mao, Pol Pot, and Stalin. And the reason is because I want to deindustrialize, and because I also said that humans have exceeded carrying capacity. And I don't think that overpopulation, by the way, is a primary problem. I think overpopulation is a tertiary problem. Overpopulation, which is not to say there aren't more people than the planet can support, but the reason it's not a primary problem is because more important than overpopulation is overconsumption. So the important thing is ecological footprint. This is really important because when we think of overpopulation, the first images that come to mind are usually little babies of color with big bellies. But when you think of overconsumption, the first thing you think of is some asshole in an SUV, and who actually is causing more damage to the planet. So that's why it's not a primary problem, but a secondary problem. Oh, by the way, also, I love to say this. I say this whenever I'm in California. It's a big deal. There's some of the right-wingers say we need to close the border to Mexico. We, by the way, it's like, who's we? The border needs to be closed to Mexico. And I always say, yes, actually, I agree that the border should be closed between Mexico and the United States on one condition, which is that you also close it to resources. Because if you believe that the resources should come up, but the people shouldn't, that means you're just a racist who wants the coffee that's grown on land that used to be theirs. Because they don't come up because they are unhappy with their spouses, but not to the point in therapy where they can actually say something to the spouse. And so they have to come up here for an eco-tour of the strawberry fields of San Joaquin Valley. They come up because their community has been unraveled. Well, actually, that's not true. They come up because their land's been stolen. I mean, let's just cut to the chase. Anyway, so it's a secondary problem because consumption's more important. And it's actually a tertiary problem because there have been many cultures that have existed in a steady state. I mean, the people lived in what is now occupied Totnes. That's where I live, in occupied Talawa homeland. Human beings lived there for at least 12,000 years, if you believe science, and if you believe their own stories, they lived there since the beginning of time. And they did that in part by not overconsuming and not overpopulating. And so there is a mindset that leads to this behavior. The point is that she was upset because I want to deindustrialize, and let's be really honest, deindustrializing is going to kill a lot of people because the entire industrial agriculture system is based on natural gas and oil. And if you take down the natural gas and oil infrastructure, well, the people in the rural people in the third world, I think, will be much better off immediately. Rural people in the United States will be okay. Urban people, I mean, like the rich people in cities in the United States, I don't care because they're a problem anyway. I go back and forth on how things will be for the urban people of the so-called third world, because on one hand, sort of food shipments would stop flowing in immediately, but on the other hand, food shipments would stop flowing out immediately. And also, talk about instant land reform, just stop giving the rich people of the third world guns, and the poor people are going to suddenly discover they've got access to a lot of land. It's an interesting question, and I mean, the truth is, every cell of my body wants for there to be a voluntary transformation, wants for us to sort of ease off, or them to ease off, or whatever, and for there to be this soft landing, and for people to suddenly get smart about population and consumption and all that, but it ain't going to happen. Okay, so on one hand, if you actively work to bring stuff down, there's a lot of people who are going to suffer, die. If you don't actively work to bring stuff down, it's going to come down eventually, and then there's going to be a lot of people, a lot more people die. So it's like, what the hell do you do? I get to like page 400, and I can't go on because of this woman's question, which I mean, I don't agree with the Mao, Pol Pot, and Stalin thing, but she raises a good point. And then finally, I came up with an answer. Is Becky Tarbottom here, by the way? Okay, because she, I actually stole the answer directly from her, and so if she was here, I wanted to give her credit, but if she's not here, then I came up with it all on my own. Anyway, if you've gotten this far in this book, or if you're anything other than entirely insensate, we probably agree that civilization is going to crash, whether or not we help bring it about. If you don't agree with this, we probably have nothing to say to each other. How about them Red Sox? We probably also agree that this crash will be messy. We agree further that since industrial civilization is systematically dismantling the ecological infrastructure of the planet, the sooner civilization comes down, whether or not we help it crash, the more life will remain afterwards to support both humans and non-humans. If you agree with all this, and if you don't want to dirty your spirituality and conscience with the physical work of helping to bring down civilization, and if your primary concern really is for the well-being of those humans who will be alive during and immediately after the crash, then given, and I repeat this point to emphasize it, that civilization is going to come down anyway, you need to start preparing people for the crash. Instead of coming to my talks and attacking me for stating the obvious, go rip up asphalt and vacant parking lots to convert them to neighborhood gardens. Go teach people how to identify local edible plants, even in the city, especially in the city, so these people won't starve when they can no longer head off to Albertsons for groceries. Set up committees to eliminate or, if appropriate, channel the additional violence that might break out. We need it all. We need people to take out dams, and we need people to knock out electrical infrastructures. We need people to protest and to chain themselves to trees. We also need people working to ensure that as many people as possible are equipped to deal with the fallout when the collapse comes. We need people working to teach others what wild plants to eat, what plants are natural antibiotics. We need people teaching others how to purify water, how to build shelters. All of this can look like supporting traditional, local knowledge. It can look like starting rooftop gardens. And it can look like teaching people how to sing. The truth is that although I do not believe that designing groovy eco-villages will help bring down civilization, when the crash comes, I'm sure to be first in line knocking on their doors asking for food. People taking out dams do not have a responsibility to ensure that people in homes previously powered by hydro know how to cook over a fire. They do, however, have a responsibility to support the people doing that work. Similarly, those people growing medicinal plants do not have a responsibility to take out dams. They do, however, have a responsibility at the very least to not condemn those people who have chosen that work. It's the same old story. The good thing about everything being so f***ed up is that no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. Do what you love. Do what you can. Do what best serves your land base. We need it all. This doesn't mean that everyone taking out dams and everyone working to cultivate medicinal plants are working toward the same goals. It does mean that if they are, each should see the importance of the other's work. Further, resistance needs to be global. Acts of resistance are more effective when they're large-scale and coordinated.
The infrastructure is monolithic and centralized, so common tools and techniques can be used to dismantle it in many different places simultaneously if possible. The work of renewal must be local. I have a new phrase, dismantle globally, renew locally. To be truly effective, acts of survival and livelihood need to grow from particular land bases where they will thrive. People need to enter into conversation with each piece of earth and all its human and non-human inhabitants. This doesn't mean, of course, that we can't share ideas or that one water purification technique won't be useful in many different locations. It does mean that people in those places need to decide for themselves what will work. Most important of all, the water in each place needs to be asked and allowed to decide for itself. I've been thinking a lot again about the cell phone tower behind Safeway, and I see now how these different approaches manifest in this one small place. The cell phone tower needs to come down. It is contiguous on two sides with abandoned parking lots. Those lots need to come up. Gardens can bloom in their place. We can even do our work side by side. Okay, so I'll talk about hope for a minute. Several years ago, a friend of mine called me late one night. She's an activist, works on pesticide issues in Northern California. She called me late one night and said, you know, this work is so hard. It's so painful. It's killing me. I said, yeah, I know. I can do that. And then she said, you know, the dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does, even itself. She said, unless it's stopped, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? I said, yeah, it is. She said, it has a death urge, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does. She said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? I thought a moment, and then I said the thing I knew all along was the best thing I could say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason I said that to her is because about 10 years ago, I was having a similar breakdown. I was just bursting into tears, three or four times a week over the salmon, grizzly bears. I mean, you name it. And a lot of my environmentalist friends would tell me, you know, just back off, Derek. Take some time off because the problems will still be there when you come back. And I knew I couldn't do that. I knew that if you're not going to cry about the death of the salmon, what are you going to cry about? You know, if tears are going to mean anything at all, it kills me. I was in Colorado last week, and I'm sure you know this, that black-tailed prairie dogs are getting hammered. Black-tailed prairie dogs will live next to the interstate. You know, if they are that adaptable, and they're still getting hammered. So anyway, one day, you know, I was just breaking into sobs. I knew I had to keep pushing. And one day, I called my friend Jeanette Armstrong. I said, you know, this work is just, sometimes it's so painful. And she said, yeah, I know it is. And I said, you know, the dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does, even itself. And I said, it has a death urge, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does. I said, unless it stops, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? She said, yeah, it is. And then I said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And then she said the best possible thing she could say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason that was the best possible thing she could say is because it normalized my despair and let me know that despair is an appropriate response to a desperate situation and let me know that the sorrow is just sorrow and the pain is just pain. And it let me know it's not so much the sorrow or even pain that hurts as it is my resistance to it. One of the smartest things that the Nazis did was they co-opted rationality and they co-opted hope. And the way they did that was by making it so that at every step of the way, it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. Would you rather get an ID card or would you rather resist and possibly get killed? Would you rather move to a ghetto, reserve, reservation? Would you rather resist and possibly get killed? Would you rather get on a cattle car? Would you rather resist, possibly get killed? You want to go in and take a shower? You want to resist and possibly get killed? But I'll tell you something very interesting. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. Remember that over the next 10 years. One of the reasons that my mother stayed with my father was because there weren't battered women's shelters in the 50s and 60s. But another reason that she stayed with him was because of the false hope that he would change. False hopes. We'll get to hopes in a second. False hopes bind us to unlivable situations, and they blind us to real possibilities. I mean, does anybody really believe that Weyerhaeuser is going to stop deforesting because we asked nicely? Does anybody really think that Monsanto is going to stop Monsantoing because we asked nicely? False hopes. False hopes. Another thing, by the way, that keeps us tied to unlivable situations is I've heard a lot that we should never take out dams because that'll actually hurt the river more than leaving the dam stand. And that's such bull. And I was talking to some fisheries biologists about that. It was so funny. I would call them up and I would say, so if somebody were to blow up a dam, would that actually hurt the river below it? And hello? Hello? It took me a couple, three tries to figure out how to sort of mask the rhetoric. What I eventually said was, okay, so let's pretend that it's 2015 and the oil economy has collapsed and the electrical infrastructure has collapsed and the people in your community have some explosives and they are asking you whether it would be in the river's best interest to remove the dam, recognizing this is 2015, it's a long ways away and it's theoretical. And when I gave them that out, oh my God, it was so cool. They were like, oh, blow it. Blow it. Yes, absolutely. Now. And, you know, rivers dam all the time, you know, with landslides, with lava flows, all that. That's part of a river's natural process. And then the dam breaks. And every time, I love this phrase, every time it creates, and also, you know, a river is not this area between the banks. I mean, a river, if you look at it in terms of a river's own natural history, they writhe like snakes. You know, they're all over the place. The thing that the fisheries biologists were saying that I just loved was that every time a river changes its course, every time it breaks through a dam, it causes short-term habitat loss, long-term habitat gain. And, okay, the reason I love that is, like, that's it. That's why we stay in shitty relationships. That's why we stay in jobs we hate. That's why we don't bring down civilization. That's why all this stuff is because we're afraid of the short-term habitat loss so we don't get to the long-term habitat gain. About 18 months ago, I was in Colorado, and I was giving a talk, and I was bashing hope, and somebody in the audience said, so can you define hope, please? And I said, oh, I've been bashing it for years. I don't even know what I'm talking about. And so I did what any self-respecting person would do, which is I turned it back around them and said, so smarty pants, what's your definition? And he came up with a great definition. Actually, the whole audience did. It was great. I mean, they were like bouncing out back and forth off each other. The definition they came up with was, hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. Because I don't hope that I eat something tonight. I don't hope that I sleep. I'm going to do it. The car was shimmying all the way down from Crescent City, so I do hope that I make it home. And it smells like burning rubber, too. This is very bad, 350 miles away from home. So anybody knows about cars, let's talk later. That actually wasn't a joke. Okay, but the next time I get on an airplane, I hope it doesn't crash because I have no agency. And so what hope is, fundamentally then, if you accept this definition, which you don't have to, but under this definition, hope is an acknowledgement of your own powerlessness. So I don't hope that coho salmon survive. I will do what it takes to make sure that they survive if they don't like the way they're being treated and they want to go extinct, I will say goodbye and I will miss them. But I will not allow the dominant culture to drive them extinct. I don't hope they survive. It was so cool. When I was at Mill Creek yesterday, there were the two salmon. One came by earlier. One other one came by right when I said that. It came right up next to the, it's a pretty small creek, and it came right up next to the bank, moving very slow. It was a huge salmon, and opening her mouth wide and closing it. And I was thinking, okay, either she's saying, right on, groovy tunes, man. Or she's saying, coho, what about the Chinook? Can we talk about the Chinook for a second? I think she was saying one of those two. Okay, so now we will read this, because this is a really sweet thing to end on. And of course, after talking about the apocalypse, you do have to end on a happy note. Pretend you're a river. Pretend you are the mist who falls so fine, so gentle, that nothing separates water and air. You're the rain who falls in sheets, explodes onto the ground to leave pox and puddles. You're the ground who receives this water, soaking it up, taking it in, carrying it deep inside. You're the cracks and fissures where the waters accumulate, flow, fall to join more water and more, in pools and rivers who move slowly through cavities, crevices, pores. You are the sounds and silence of water seeping or staying still. You are the meeting of wet and dry, the union of liquid and solid, where solids dissolve and liquids solidify. You are the pressure who pushes water through seams. You are the rushing water who bubbles from the earth. You are a tiny pool between rocks. You overflow, find your way to join others who, like you, are moving, moving. You are the air at the surface of the water, the joining of substantial and insubstantial, the union of under and over, weight and not weight. You are the riffle, the rapid, the tiny waterfall who turns water to air and air to water. You are the mist who settles on the soil. You are the plants who drink the mist, and you are the sun who warms and feeds them. You are the fish who feed on insects, who feed on plants, who feed on soils, who feed on fish. You are the fish who become soils, who become plants, who become insects, who become fish, who flow down the river. You are the river who joins other rivers to become a new river who is all the rivers and something else. You are the river. You do not stop at the banks where liquid turns to solid. You reach into the sky and into the soil. Water moves through rocks, comes up to form pools far from the fast flow where the rivers move together, seeps down to join still waters deep below the surface, waters who sleep and wake and sleep and mingle with the stones who are the river too. You are the river who is married to the mountains you have known since they were young, who have given themselves to you as you have given yourself to them. You are the canyons you nestle into, each year deeper than the year before. You are the forests who give you their fallen trees, the meadows you flood and feed, and who feed you back their fruits and fine insects who fly to your surface to be taken in by the fish who with their own bodies again feed the meadows. You are the river who feeds the ocean, who feels the tides pushing and pulling against your mouth, the waves mixing fresh and salt. You are that intermingling. That is who you are. That is who you have always been. You are the river. You have lived with volcanoes and glaciers. You have been dammed by lava and ice. You have carried log jams so large and so old that they grow their own forests with you running beneath. You have lived through droughts and floods. You are the river. You miss the salmon. You miss the sturgeon. You miss the ocean. You miss the meadows. You miss the forests. You miss the beavers and otters and grizzly bears. You miss the humans. You are the river. You want them back. You want to feel the tickling of the sturgeon, the thrusting of the salmon. You want to carry food and soil to the ocean. You want to cover the meadows as you used to, and you want to give yourself to them, and you want them to give themselves to you as you have done forever and as they have too. Now, pretend you are a forest. You are the bark of trees and the hairy moss who hangs from them. You are the duff who becomes soil, who becomes trees, who becomes seeds, who becomes squirrels, who become owls, who become slugs, who become shrews, who become soil. You are the trees who cannot live without the fungi, who cannot live without the voles, who cannot live without the trees. You are the fire who cannot live without the trees, who cannot live without the woodpeckers, who cannot live without the beetles, who cannot live without the fire. You are the wind who speaks through the trees and the trees who speak through the wind. You are the birds who sing and the birds who do not. You are the salamanders, the ferns, the millipedes, the bumblebees who sleep on flowers waiting for the morning to warm you up so you can eat and fly on home. You too have lived through drought and flood, hot and cold. And you too miss the salmon. You miss the owls, the grizzly bears. You miss the rivers. You miss the people, the humans. You want them all back. You need them back, or you will die. Thank you.